Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table, where we discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, Texas. And today our subject is religious liberty. We're returning to this topic. A few months ago, we had our first guest, Kelly Shackelford, who's sitting in studio with me, president and CEO of the Liberty Institute, which is the largest organization focused on religious liberty in the country, with us. And he introduced the topic of religious liberty to us in anticipation of the Hobby Lobby decision, which now has come down. But not only has the Hobby Lobby decision come down, but we've also had an injunction related to another very closely related case involving Wheaton College. And as a matter of disclosure, I should say I serve on the board of Wheaton College, so I'm very, very aware of what this case involves and have a little bit of a vested interest in the process. And then via Skype, we have retired federal judge Roland von Brookhoven, who is a former federal judge. I've got these two legal experts to help us parse what happens in the courts with regard to this issue, because for us average day, everyday folk, sometimes it's hard for us to understand the hows and the whys of what's going on and what the rules of the game are. And so my job is to keep them communicating at a level that we all will understand. And so you're going to be sitting off the back of my ignorant shoulders so that I can help parse and make sure that we're all talking the same language. So Kelly and Roland, thank you for coming in and being a part of this with us. Kelly, we really appreciated you being with us last time and look forward to what you're going to offer to us in help today. And Roland, it's great to have you with us as well. Roland, if you remember, did an earlier Table podcast as well when the initial same-sex marriage decision was issued, about a year and a half ago. And he walked us through those Supreme Court decisions and what was going on culturally. So I have got two very qualified people to speak with us. Well, gentlemen, let me dive in. We got the Hobby Lobby decision, and I'm going to let the judge explain what happened and make whatever preliminary remarks he wants to make about how and why it happened, and then that'll set the table for the rest of our discussion. For those of you who don't remember, the Hobby Lobby case was a case of a corporation run by Christians that had a religious liberty objection to the mandate that required them to supply birth control and other kinds of contraceptive elements, among other things, to their employees. And so they challenged their lack of status, if I can say it that way, in the courts. And the decision came down over the summer. Judge, the floor is yours. What did the Supreme Court decide, and how should we think about it?
Well, first of all, I might just add that the statement has been made recently that the current administration has done a great deal in terms of unifying the country, both left, center, and right, against many of its policies. And the Supreme Court is no different. What is rather interesting is that the unanimous decisions of the Supreme Court are significantly larger than those of divided decisions. We tend to focus on the divided decisions. And certainly in the case of the Windsor case a little over a year ago with the same sex marriage issue, and now Hobby Lobby, these tend to suck the wind out of all of us. It strikes me that there are basically three things going on in the criticism of the court that don't get to the substance of what is being decided. The first one is a pro-business claim. A lot of people claim that the Roberts Court is a has a pro-business bias, and it decides in favor of business. The Hobby Lobby case fits generally within that argument. The second argument is that there's a proclivity to take cautious steps. Part of Justice Roberts' interest is unifying the court and protecting its reputation. And so here, although in the briefs, both the First Amendment and the Freedom of Religion Restoration Act were dealt with, the court only dealt with the statutory issue under the Restoration Act itself. And so we get into questions of statutory interpretation rather than the larger issues that are raised constitutionally. And the third thing is the hysteria which seems to greet these decisions, particularly on the left. Justice Ginsburg's dissent in Hobby Lobby is way off the chart. It's just really over the top. And so it takes a great deal of credibility away from perhaps some of the arguments she might have otherwise made. In the case of the Wheaton College injunction, there is a rather simple injunction issued by the Supreme Court against Wheaton having to follow the mandate. And yet Justice Sotomayor wrote a 17-page dissent to that injunction. And this is completely unheard of, it seems to me. And so you have this whipping up of the various sides and the hysteria that accompanies those. So that kind of sets a bit of the background, it seems to me, on how we might look at Hobby Lobby.
Okay, so let's take a look at you've tempted me, and I'm resisting temptation to dive into more detail on some of what you're saying here. Let me do this much before we actually look at the decision, and that is what you're saying is that in one sense all three of these reactions are not appropriate ways to think about what we're getting ready to discuss. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what I'm saying. But that's the way most people hear it when we read the newspapers.
Okay.
These are the basic criticisms, to a certain extent, against the legitimacy of the court.
Okay.
So, and so I think that's important to carry that idea.
So the corollary with that is that there really are important legal questions that need to be resolved here, as opposed to viewing this through kind of either a sociological lens or a lens that says, well, there's a strategy for how this is being done and gone and how the court is going about it. Am I reading that right as well in your remarks?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing in the Hobby Lobby case or the amicus curiae briefs, mm-hmm. and you get a lot out of the amicus curiae briefs that you don't necessarily get in either the decision or the basic briefs by the Green family or the two main parties.
Now I'm going to have to ask you to translate the technical language for folks, because amicus curiae is going to mean absolutely schmatz to a lot of people. So can you help us with that?
Well, we're talking about friend of courts.
Okay.
The briefs that are submitted on behalf of multiple parties that might be affected by an adverse decision or that want to shape the direction of the decision.
Okay, so these are briefs that come alongside the major briefs that basically give support to the particular case, one side or the other, of that's being argued.
I think that's right.
Okay. All right. Let's turn our attention directly to the decision. Well, let me ask it this way: since you said there's a real issue wrapped up in this, in your view, what is the issue that the court? was trying to decide in relationship to Hobby Lobby, and maybe that's the wrong way to ask it, what issues, could be more than one, is the court trying to balance as they deal with, as they dealt with the Hobby Lobby case and the claim that Hobby Lobby says that they should receive some kind of an exemption for this mandate? Roland?
Yeah, okay. I guess there's several issues. When I first picked up Hobby Lobby this summer, I was struck by the fact that it seemed like the court had forgotten 200 years worth of legal history or jurisprudence. The big issue immediately became, is Hobby Lobby a person? And that was decided by the trustees of Dartmouth case in 1819.
All certainly remember.
Well, obviously the court didn't remember. Although Justice Ginsburg did talk a little bit about that. But the fact that corporations have been regarded as persons is nothing new, and it wasn't decided in the Hobby Lobby case. Now, the question is, even though they're an artificial person, what rights can they assert? And to a large extent, the courts have held over the years, going back to the late 19th century, that they can, for example, assert rights under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So the fact that the court is asserting, is allowing a corporation to act as a person asserting rights that individuals can assert, is nothing particularly new. And yet, it seemed like both the majority and the dissent labored over that question, probably more than was necessary.
And let me point out, okay, I was in the front of the Supreme Court during the argument. A friend of mine argued the case. And it's shocking to listen to what the Solicitor General of the United States was arguing. Hmm. I mean, this is not an exaggeration. His argument was that once you decide to go into a for-profit business and incorporate, you are making the decision to waive your religious freedoms. Hmm. And, quote, you're now playing by the government's rules. That's what he said. Hmm. And, you know, it's just think of what that would mean. I mean, mm-hmm. anybody who wants to feed their family and incorporate, you know, to make money and have a business, you know, the place where they spend most of their waking hours, you know, those rights are gone. As the judge said, it would have been an extreme departure from many, many years of law. But that's what was being argued. And, you know, what's scary is, I mean, I don't know how many justices away, you know, evidently one mm-hmm. from maybe that becoming the law. So that, you know, that was a very good first step in that was rejected. But it's to me, even if that's being argued, I think is very disturbing.
Now, as we work our way through what this decision is, we're going to have to come to grips, for people who are just lay people, with certain phrases that are a part of the conversation in the discussion. One of those phrases is a closely held business. What is a closely held business? And there seems to be a distinction that's being made between businesses, those that are closely held, and then I don't know what the alternative expression is. If it's not closely held, what is it, just a business? I mean, I don't know what the alternative is. But what's the point of making that kind of a distinction? Because it seems like this decision applies to certain kinds of businesses, but not to other kinds of businesses. Is that?
I just think they're being careful to say, in this case, we've got a closely held corporation, so it's the corporation is more akin to the individuals who run it and own it. You know, it's not like a public, you know, corporation. But I mean, in reality, mm-hmm. I don't think the argument should change. I mean, I know of publicly traded corporations that Christians, it's a Christian company, and a majority own the stock. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would think it would apply there. I just think the court was being very careful not to talk about things that weren't before it, and says there, you know, in, if you're closely held, that's what this case is. This clearly applies. They didn't say it didn't apply to others.
Okay.
They just said we're not there yet, and that's not the case before us. I think they're being careful.
Okay. So the point here is that you have owners who are Christian of this corporation, and so and the case that they're making is we have the right to apply our religious values to how our corporation is run. That was the basic position. Is that right, Kelly?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So the decision came down, and let's talk about.
Let me, if I might, just okay. back up a minute.
Okay.
Support what Kelly said. The Supreme Court, or any court for that matter, is to decide only the issues that are before that court. And so when we get all wrapped up in this question of closed corporation versus a public corporation or individuals, we're really not addressing a principle of litigation, that you're only litigating the basic question that has been presented in the lower courts and that has worked up through the process. I think it would have been horrible for Justice Alito to expand beyond, which is basically what Justice Ginsburg tried to do in every instance, expand beyond the basic issues that had been litigated before and it came to the court.
Well, this is precisely why we have you all here, so that you can help us explain the rules of the game and what's being asked and required of people as we think through this. And I feel like we're slowly working our way towards the discussion of the actual decision. But basically what was decided here was that and Kelly, this is for you, the Greens were given the right to exercise their religious freedom in the context of how their corporation was being run. Is that the fundamental decision?
Yes, that was step one, which again the judge said shouldn't have had to be a step, but it was forced because okay. they made this argument that, you know, corporations don't have religious freedom. Once they got by that, they got to the guts issue of the case, which is, under the Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, mm-hmm. And again, he mentioned that earlier too, mm-hmm. the court didn't, this was not a constitutional decision. This was not a what the free exercise of religion says. There's a statute that's passed called the Religious Freedoms Restoration
Act. That's right.
They simply applied that and asked, you know, the questions. The way that statute works is a test that you would normally apply in when a fundamental constitutional rights are at stake, which is called the compelling interest test. And what they do in that case, in that test, is they ask the first question: was a person's, or in this case, you know, the corporation's sincerely held religious beliefs burdened? And that's just a matter of, you really only people that can answer that question are the individual before the court.
Mm-hmm.
They said yes. I don't think anybody doubts that mm-hmm. they had a religious objection to 4 of the 20.
And the decisions
drugs.
Actually alluded to the fact that they did bear this, that they recognized and acknowledged this burden.
Right. Yeah. And so that's step one. So once you trigger that and you show that the government is now burdening someone's religion, then the burden of proof shifts to the government to prove that it has a compelling governmental interest that is requiring this infringement, and that what the government is doing to accomplish this compelling governmental interest is the least restrictive way to do it on the offended party. And that's something that they couldn't meet. In this mm-hmm. case, in particular, what the court said is, look, there are other accommodations. You look at what the nonprofits have been offered. They've been offered a specific accommodation. That wasn't offered to the for-profit. So that alone shows this was not the least restrictive way. Therefore, this is unconstitutional. So they went to that least restrictive means and said, you don't meet the burden under the test. You can't prove that this is the least restrictive way to burden Hobby Lobby and similar groups. And so under the Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, you violate that act, and therefore, you know, we're going to enjoin you from all these heavy penalties, which they would have punished Hobby Lobby with. Hobby Lobby said they would have gone out of business.
Yeah, I mean, these penalties are so large that they're millions of dollars because so many people are involved. Okay.
I think one thing that I might add to okay. what Kelly just said is the the court assumed that mandating all of these contraceptive methods was a compelling interest of the government. I'm not ready to buy that assumption, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure why they made that assumption. As the brief from Westminster Theological Seminary said, really, pregnancy is not a disease, and providing all of these do not promote the health of women, and whether the statistics were there to support the idea that women were prevented from engaging in the workplace is simply were not articulated in this case. But it does strike me that Alito, for whatever reason, simply assumed the compelling interest, and I see nothing in the record, either in the decision or any of the briefs, that would suggest that providing all 21 of these contraceptives would promote a compelling interest of the government.
That's an interesting observation, and you're again working with something that I'm going to take a moment to explain to the lay folks, and that is that when a case is in front of someone, it's the burden of the lawyers on each side to present the facts of the case to the court through their briefs. And it's on the basis of those briefs and what gets presented to the court in relationship to the law that the case gets decided. I mean, I know this is basic legal 101, but I think for some people who don't understand how courts work, it isn't that I can think of any argument I want. It's got to be formally presented to the court. Is that right, Kelly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, formally presented to the lower court.
To the lower courts. Yeah. Okay.
And the trial court or the appellate court, it doesn't even get to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And let me lay out something, because I think this is an important issue for people to understand, sort of before we go into Wheaton and everything else. We talked about accommodation.
Right.
The reality is that if the government really, really thinks it's important to provide these particular four drugs that many believers find are abortion-causing drugs.
Right, right.
If the government really thought that that was something crucial or compelling, it could simply provide it to people.
Yes.
And instead, what it is doing, and it's going out of its way to do this, is it's trying to, instead of that easy solution, if that was the issue they really cared about, mm-hmm. that would be solved in no time. They'd just say, we'll provide these.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what they're doing is they're trying to force all religious entities to be the ones
who trigger this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, what is really going on here is the government is trying to get a precedent that they can force religious entities to violate their conscience, and it's totally unnecessary.
Here's another question that I have, and this and thinking about this as a layperson looking at what's going on, and that is, when you sign on to an accommodation, you actually are acknowledging the government's right to make you sign on to that accommodation. That means that's something that they can potentially take back down the road. Isn't it? Doesn't it mean we're showing you grace and we're being kind by giving you this accommodation? If you sign on, you're buying into your recognition that you are compelled to respond to us on this issue. It seems to me that's another element of this conversation. Am I right about that?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a lot of different, you know, one of the things about accommodations is, as with any sincerely held religious belief, it's really not up to the government or judges to decide what they think is a rational religious objection.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is simply to decide, is it sincere?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a prisoner and all of a sudden I feel like I become a member of the church of the filet mignon, you know, that's not going to go.
Right.
But they really shouldn't be in the business of saying, well, I don't think that your objection to this makes a lot of sense to me.
Right.
That's really not an inquiry that judges should be involved in. And so really, if people and churches and entities come forward and say, this violates our faith and our conscience, that really should be all that matters when it comes to whether the accommodation really, you know, actually avoids violating their religious beliefs and their rights.
Okay, I'm kind of ticking off the issues that we're working through here that are involved in this singular case. This is one case, but it's got lots of elements to it. We've already ticked off the idea that corporations can operate and have rights like persons. We've already ticked off the idea that accommodation in one way or another is a way of acknowledging, or it could be read as acknowledging the government's right to have authority in this kind of an area. That's a certain kind of impingement. We've already ticked off the fact that the way this is being done is forcing the business, and eventually we're going to be talking about schools, to trigger the process, and it's their insurer who ends up covering what's being asked for. So that's another way being involved. And it seems to me that the fourth issue is the question, the actual legal, formal, narrow legal question, if I can say it that way, of figuring out the least restrictive way to make all this work. And now my question is, having ticked off those four, am I missing anything?
No, I think those are, you know, the big issues. And I think the last one you said, there's an obvious answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, that's what sort of hangs over all of this.
Yeah.
Is there a least restrictive means? Yes, the government provides them.
Yeah.
If it's so important to the government, they can provide them. It's not a problem. And so that's going to be the problem, I think, with all of these legal actions in the future, is the court didn't say in Hobby Lobby that it's this one type of accommodation. That they just said, look, that's an example that there are accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the ultimate accommodation is, do you have to force religious groups to be put to this Hobson's choice of my faith or, you know, government penalties?
Mm-hmm.
You don't even have to have them in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to go through the religious groups. You, the government, can just provide them yourself. But that's not what they're trying to do. And so they're going to all, I mean, until that is switched, there will be religious objections, and religious groups are going to be fighting this until the very end.
And they're fighting it for a variety of reasons. They're fighting it at the level of the protection of the individual rights that are involved, both at the individual and corporate levels, particularly the more corporate levels involving schools and businesses. They're fighting it because they're being asked to trigger something that they're actually underwriting. By there being their own insurance organization that's dealing with, and by signing on to the accommodation, they feel like they're signing on to at least the potential of giving away a right that the Constitution recognizes that they possess. And I think it's important that those things be clear, because I think in the way this has been covered, my sense is that almost none of those issues are raised to any public awareness at all as to why it is people are concerned. Let me raise one other issue before we press on here, and it's this. Sometimes in listening to the response to this, you get the feeling that what is being said about the people who are trying to defend and stand up for religious liberty is, well, you just don't want people to have access to these drugs. You know, that really, the deep down, what you are saying is you disagree with abortion, you disagree with, it may be birth control, depending on where you are on the religious spectrum, and so you just don't want this to happen. So you're putting up every possible obstacle in the world to keep that from happening and to distance your involvement from it. I think the distance the involvement from it part is probably true. But I think it's unfair to suggest, I think, that the position of people who are defending religious liberty in this case are arguing, we don't want people to have access to this type of care if they choose to want to exercise it. No one that I'm aware of is saying that. Am I?
No, that's right. I think the access argument is a false argument. It's a media term for people who don't think or understand the case. It's, again, nothing about Hobby Lobby saying we don't want to provide this is saying that they can't have access to it anywhere they want.
Right.
I mean, it's like saying, you know, if you don't provide it, there's no access. I mean, they could get it, you know, all kinds of places.
And it could be set up to be provided for in all kinds of places.
Exactly. The government could provide that easily. There's a lot of places, clinics and places that provide that anyway. But the idea that somehow women don't have access to birth control if their employer doesn't give it to them is a farce.
And so that's part of the reason, Judge, why I take it you said earlier that some of the reaction to this represents a form of hysteria, which is a very vivid description of it, because it is an overreaction to actually what's being decided in the case. Is that fair? Rollin?
That is fair. Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. Join us next week for part two. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.